Welcome to the Gay Buddhist Forum, where teachers from all schools of Buddhism offer their perspectives on the Dharma and its application in modern times, especially for LGBTQI audiences. These talks are offered freely to the world and made possible by appreciative listeners. If you would like to support our efforts to share the Dharma with underserved audiences, please visit gaybuddhist.org. There you can donate, find a list of upcoming speakers, or enjoy many hundreds of these recorded talks dating back to 1996.
Jim.
George.
My name is Henry.
My name is Juan.
My name is Michael.
Well, my name is Philip.
We'll love
you. I'm Harley.
My name is Chris.
Gary.
And Joe.
Great. So this morning we had the pleasure of hearing from one of our longtime meditators, Joe Rodriguez. Joe is a Soto Zen student from the Shunryu Suzuki lineage, studying under Furyu Nancy Schroeder, the Abiding Goddess in Green Gulch Farm Zen Center, and serving as a board member of the San Francisco Zen Center. As a business executive and a longtime LGBT activist, he practices in order to bring awareness, compassion, and forgiveness to daily life. Joe, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you. Jeff, your speaker coordinator, sent me a message, and I was on vacation. And I was very relaxed, and rather than overthinking, I said, sure, I'd love to speak. And I said, how about Harvey Milk and the Buddha? I don't know why I said that. and about 4 weeks ago, I realized, oh, I have to like really connect those two things on a conscious level rather than a subconscious level. So today I really want to talk to you about two spiritual teachers of mine and the common lessons I think I've learned from them. And I think using their ideas, and I'm especially interested in talking about how we sit with ourselves with awareness, compassion, and courage, and how that can lead to greater liberation and contentment. And I'm excited about doing this at GBF and talking about Harvey Milk. I never met the guy. I wasn't out before he came out, but I thought there might be some guys here that actually met Harvey Milk, potentially. Is there anyone meet Harvey Milk? Wow, great, great. I have my perceptions of him, having heard his teachings, but I don't know him as I only know him as a legend, not the fallible man. So you can bring some of this stuff to life for us. This is going to be an informal talk. I'm actually going to use some video and audio of Harvey Milk that I got on YouTube that I thought would be just bring it to life more. And it's not so important that you see it, but I think everyone will be able to hear what's going on. And as we go, there'll be about three or four questions I pose to the community here. So you don't have to save your questions to the very end of my talk, because I'm not that type of academic speaker. Okay? All right. I think if there's, you know, if nothing else, Buddhism is a primer on suffering and the nature of suffering, its causes and conditions, and its ways to lessen its grip on us. And I think one of the habits of mind, at least my mind, is to normalize things. Even growing accustomed to persistent pain, suffering, and injustices. It's how we adapt and get through life. It's a natural human thing to do. As gay men, I think we've learned this coping mechanism as kids, adapting to our families and often hostile environments. Now and again, someone or something wakes us up to truly what is going on, including the suffering in and around us. People like the Buddha, Susan B. Anthony, Martin Luther King, Nelson Mandela, and of course Harvey Milk. Even though I spent much of my life as a human rights advocate, I still find myself taking for granted the suffering of gay people, including my own struggles. I was reminded of this phenomenon a few years ago when I came home after a long day of work and I found this incredible YouTube video that had just been posted based on an event that had taken place that day. So hopefully everything's going to go well. I can play it for you. Yeah.
To talk about the work we have left to do to protect one group of people whose human rights are still denied in too many parts of the world today. In many ways, they are an invisible minority. They are arrested, beaten, terrorized, even executed. Many are treated with contempt and violence by their fellow citizens, while authorities empowered to protect them look the other way, or too often even join in the abuse. They are denied opportunities to work and learn, driven from their homes and countries, and forced to suppress or deny who they are to protect themselves from harm. I am talking about gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender people. Human beings born free and given, bestowed equality and dignity, who have a right to claim that, which is now one of the remaining.
Yeah, thanks. I'll go to the next one in a few minutes. So, wow. When I heard that statement, and it's actually part of a 30-minute speech that Hillary Clinton, as a role of Secretary of State, gave at the UN on the signing of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights Charter, which was, I think, signed in 1947, and headed by Eleanor Roosevelt, another great woman. You know, this was a really brave speech. And, of course, I know what Hillary speaks about from some of the discrimination I've experience in my own life and suffering, as well as the countless stories I've heard from my community of discrimination, violence, things like that. But in that brief statement that she made in articulating in front of like these world leaders, she was able to wake me up to the totality of our suffering was surprising freshness. Like, I know all that. But I was reminded again, and I was able to hold all that again. And it felt tender, but also really alive. Harvey Milk, of course, was our community's great bugler and spokesperson, waking up our community to the suffering which we had endured for eons, rejecting it, and most importantly, offering us an alternative story about who we are as human beings. In the movie, in the opening of Gus Van Sant's movie about Harvey Milk's life, Milk, How many did you guys see that movie? Just raise your hands. If you remember, there was a scene, a montage of hundreds of gay men and women being arrested and photographed in police raids on gay bars and meeting spots in our beloved San Francisco. You see the secrecy, the condemnation, the discrimination, and the violence suffered by those San Franciscans. And I think most importantly, in that movie montage that begins that movie, there's this overwhelming sense of shame with queer men and women hiding from the reporters' cameras, polite society, their families and employers, and ultimately themselves. From my own experience and journey, from his own experience and life journey, Harvey understood the shame and suffering of our community. He could see it, and he clearly articulated it. And I'm going to play you a clip of Harvey talking about that. This is from a very famous speech he gave. Many of you might have known.
Somewhere in Des Moines or San Antonio, there's a young gay person who all of a sudden realizes that she or he is gay, knows that if the parents find out, they'll be tossed out of the house. The classmates would taunt the child. And the Anita Bryans and John Briggs are doing their bit on TV. And that child had several options. Staying in a closet, suicide. And then one day that child might open a paper that says homosexual elected in San Francisco. And there are two new options. The option is to go to California. Stay in San Antonio and fight. 2 days after I was elected, I got a phone call, and the voice was quite young. It was from Altoona, Pennsylvania, and the person said, thanks.
As an LGBT activist and a gay man, I have found the most insidious form of the suffering we face maybe is the deep shame that we've been taught to feel about our natural sexuality. And Harvey intimates that. We are taught that our sexuality is aberrant, disgusting, selfish, a crime against nature, and as my favorite, Pope Benedict said, intrinsically evil. And as gay men in particular, we've been told that we are defective, not man enough, what a waste, and essentially unlovable. The resulting shame is insidious because it tends to penetrate our thinking, our self-concept, and often the way we relate to one another. Most importantly, I think, instead of being affirmed for our sexual orientation like most young straight men are, society told us that there is something terribly wrong with ourselves, something broken, or missing. Or in the words of Christian psychologists, our sexuality needs to be repaired. This shame often leads to what one psychologist has called a velvet rage, when we turn the stifled hatred and anger around ourselves and each other. And like all human beings do, we do anything to escape our shame and suffering. By trying to live the perfect gay life, trying to overachieve at work and be validated through that, seeking external status and success, zoning out by buying things, drinking and drugging, and sometimes by taking our own lives. I'm sure you have more examples of how we persecute ourselves. But for me, as a follower of the Buddhist Way, awakening to and sitting with my suffering is an important gate that I must pass through. Understanding that I was shamed about my native sexuality as I grew up by my church, parents, community, school, the scouts, you name it. Understanding my anger when I read about a gay high school student killing themselves in Minnesota or in Kansas, We're hearing about the only safe place for homeless queer youth in Jamaica is the sewers. Understanding the shame I've suffered and noticing when it gets triggered as an adult, too. Like when my former boyfriend told me that I was driving a chick's car, my bright blue Miata. But again, you know, that's one of the ways we sort of invalidate ourselves. And before I go really much further, I want to talk just a little bit, open it up to the group. In what ways have you suffered as a gay person that you tend to take for granted? And any ways you might have suffered shame? I know it's a heavy thing, but it's going to get lighter as we go. Any examples or comments? Yes.
I'll just bang off of yours. I have to say that as I'm a kind of a car nut, and sometimes it's about getting a Subaru, and I have to confess I resist it because it's sort of a regulation lesbian. You can cover a good car, just this
one. But you could be our honorary male lesbian. Yes, go ahead.
I guess part of what comes up for me often in my job is related to my experience in school as a child, and that the kind of shame you talked about, and conditioning that what I am is wrong, and growing up in a Catholic household and that kind of thing. But I'm a teacher, and every time I come in contact, maybe not every time, most times when I come in contact with a parent, I am somehow subconsciously or consciously aware of the fact that I'm gay teaching children, and that some people think that is wrong.
Still, yeah.
Including some of my parents. So it's deep. Every day.
Yeah, that's a great example of that. And I'm sure that fear is palpable, even with some of those people, like have gay friends, but there's still this lingering fear about gay people. Yes.
Well, that actually reminds me, I'm actually also a teacher too, and I have the same experience. But I was thinking about the fact that even like people who like are your friends and your allies and other gay people, like when we contribute, I guess in the same way that women often contribute to sexism, then when we as gay people contribute to like homophobia by like monitoring and saying things like what you said that your partner said to you, like I feel like there's this constant work that we have to do in our own community with our friends and gay family, and kind of speaking out and correcting that, like when bringing that to light, like that's a form of suffering that when you have to actually educate your own friends and gay family about the homophobic comments they say, and how something so slight can actually be quite damaging. And I was just thinking, like, not only about the comment you said about your partner, but also that, like, there's this boy at school who I was going to mentor this summer, because we have a very close connection as my student. And I was ending up camping, and I didn't even think about anything about it because I feel so comfortable and safe and out at school that it's not a big deal for me for the most part, but it's still there. And one of my best friends said to me, she like, oh, I don't like the idea of you taking him camping, she said. But not as, she didn't say this in a way to, because she thought something would happen, more so the fact that I would have to be concerned of something, that I could be accused of something. And then just thinking, well, having such good intentions, and like, you know, I only felt love for this boy in a completely non-sexual way, but like that could be somehow construed as something else. It's very painful to think about that.
Yeah, that's a great example. I personally, I was a big brother for a long time. Kids like my son now, but the first 2 or 3 years of his of our relationship, I didn't bring him to my home because I was afraid, of the same sort of thing, you know. And finally, his mom says, "Well, are you going to invite him to stay over?" You know, again, that sort of fear. Yes.
I know that I can be very lack a lot of compassion towards myself. I can be very self-critical, and I've been looking at that lately. It's been my path to look at that, and it's just there's a part of me that's agreeing with all the voices that came from outside, and I'm deficient. And so when I do something that, you know, I make a mistake or say something inartful, there's this voice that just really comes down hard and criticizes me for that. And I know that comes from just growing up being shamed all the time and just interiorizing that voice. And that's something I struggle with. I really am working to try to be more compassionate towards myself. But it sometimes it's hard to do that.
That's so well said. I mean, yeah. I mean, that cutting of ourselves and then cutting of others, it happens. It's just very common. You know?
And yeah, so I would never treat other people sometimes the way I treat myself.
Of course.
And it just, I just need to realize that and just see, and not beat myself up for beating myself up. I mean, it could just go on and on and on.
Right. You had a question. You had a comment.
It's a small one, but I love reading escort ads. Every day, I check all of my boys. Some come and go, you know, really into it. And there's still some that offer straight acting.
Right.
And I'm going, what's that? You know, where did that come from still? 50 years after I started seeing that.
Well, that's great.
It's a reminder. There's something that we're supposed to strive for. It's better to be straight acting.
Yeah. In fact, that's exactly where I'm going with my talk. So I'm going to continue on, and we'll take another pause in a few minutes. So the good news, as the Buddha taught, is that we have basic goodness. Innate in us, we have basic goodness. The idea at the root of our being is our Buddha nature. Deep, loving, unchangeable, no matter what you do or think. One of the primary teachings of the Buddha. That many of our problems are merely mental delusions. And Harvey saw this basic goodness in himself and other gay people. Building on the ideas of Frank Kameny that gay is good, Harvey had a revolutionary belief that gay people were just as good as heterosexuals. Not better, not worse, just as good. They didn't need fixing or changing. Gay people could be Queenie or Butch, a doctor or a truck driver, a jock or a nerd. It didn't matter. And as the Buddha preached, Harvey accepted himself just as he was and being his authentic self. Harvey didn't buy into the narrow John Wayne brand of masculinity of the 1950s, the strong, silent types that die at 55. Despite being a former football player, a former Navy officer, and an all-around athlete, Harvey was often flamboyant and campy. He had this deep belief in his and our basic goodness, which was a really radical thought. He rejected the shame that society dumped onto gay people. And he embodied this this basic goodness, being completely himself, a brash, extroverted, opinionated advocate who wasn't afraid to go out and talk in suburbia or wherever he went. He was really himself. And he challenged gay people to be or do anything they wanted to be. And I think he really understood this way of like how we shamed ourselves as kids. So he was always reaching out to LGBT youth, taking their phone calls or letters and affirming them. And I found a clip on YouTube of Stuart Milk talking about his uncle. And so I'm going to play it for you and gives you a little bit of sense of at least a family perspective of Harvey in the world.
Harvey was the most electric individual that you knew. So when he decided that his authenticity is something that needed to be celebrated, and that and it pained him that other members of the LGBT community were not being authentic. He created change just by the fact that he would enter into a dialogue on any issue and say, by the way, this is the community I represent and we share your issue with you. And so just by being himself and proclaiming who he was and who he loved in his life and not backtracking from that, even though at the time, 35 years ago, 38 years ago, when he started his campaigns, it was unheard of to do that. He created change just by being authentic. We benefit from our differences, and we benefit from not hiding them or blurring them, but we benefit from celebrating them. We have 400 or 500 openly LGBT elected officials in the country today, and I think Harvey created a new standard for that is hard to live up to, of being an openly LGBT person running for public office, putting yourself out there, putting yourself to scrutiny and to some questions.
Yeah, I think I love his use of the word authentic, being himself. And these are really the antidotes to shame. By really coming out of the shadows and saying, hey, I'm good enough. I'm as good as any other human being. I'm equal. We sort of start to neutralize that. And just like accepting ourselves, you know, exactly as we are, whether we maybe criticize like the sound of our voice or our body image or the amount of money we make or our relationship status, all the things that the ego sort of triggers us on. And especially as gay men. You know, his wholesale acceptance of himself really encouraged me to look at my internalized homophobia and the shame that I grew up with, and to really accept myself more thoroughly as a person. And I recently went to the Gay Film Festival, and I was sitting there, and there was this movie by a Dutch filmmaker, coming-of-age movie, that I just happened to see. And it was about the main character is a skinny high school runner like I was when I was 15. And through the movie, I relived the feeling of having crushes on other guys, but running away from those feelings, literally and figuratively, just like the main character did in this movie. While I don't have a clip of the movie, I wish I did, it really got me thinking, much like you, Cliff, like, how harsh I was on my 16, 17-year-old self. How much self-judgment I had and shame back then. And I was just being myself, responding to my own rhythms and my own chemistry and my own orientation. And at this time in my life, I think in my early 50s, I guess mid-50s now, I'm sort of reliving and rewinding that toxic shame I felt as a teenager through meditation, therapy, and just with talking with friends like I'm doing here today. I want to reach my inner teenager to understand his suffering and to see his basic goodness as he was back then. And, you know, you all have... I was going through photos as I was preparing for this talk, and I thought, oh, should I show him that photo of me in high school? And so I'm going to. So, I realized I came out when I was 22, but everything that happened before that, I sort of just said, oh, that was happened, but I wasn't very together, and I was a mess back then, and I didn't have a lot of compassion for that kid growing up gay. And there's this really great book that was recently, that was up for a book award last year. It's called Two Boys Kissing. And it's about the experience of growing up gay today. And it's a fictional book that's won a lot of awards. And it really triggered a lot of these feelings. So here's a picture of me in high school. You know, we're wearing my cool Kiana shirt from 1977. You know, thank you very much.
Do you still have it?
I don't. That's a good question. If I do, it's in my chest, and I haven't looked at that chest for about 10 years. But I, you know, I really want to work with that part of me and sort of owning all the parts of my life. I've really done that as an adult, but I haven't done it as a you know, my teen years and earlier. So, and some of the really painful things that I haven't really told anyone about, I'm really talking to friends about and in therapy, just so they have less power over me. And more importantly, I want to really own all of me, all of those years, all those experiences. And including, you know, when I was a kid, and I think you probably all had similar experiences, something bad would happen. Someone would call you a fag, or you didn't feel the same way that your friends did about girls, but you had no one to talk to about that. And that isolation and that loneliness, I want to surface that from that kid so it doesn't come up unconsciously in other relationships and other experiences. So I'm going to pause here for a second and see if anyone has anything they want to share at this point. Or maybe their experiences or the shame they felt as a kid.
Something politically where people like Harvey Milk and most of us in the room were tempered by the bigotry. Hopefully it made us stronger ultimately,
yeah,
and made us aware of prejudice on many levels. Whereas I've known a few people in my life who were just always out. It was the most natural thing in the world. They were diddling their little five-year-old boyfriends, and there was no struggle. I'm thinking, is it better not to have struggled at all, or to have at least struggled some, to have some awareness? I don't know.
Yeah. I think you can make the case for both things, but I do think growing up gay in a hostile society, even if you were out, you run into it, and you're affected by it. Yes, Cliff.
I struggle with hatred. And there's a time in my life where hatred was my dear enemy. I mean, my dear friend, actually, because it gave me I stopped hating myself and started hating outside, and I needed that in order to make the journey out of hating myself. But I still carry that with me. And there are times where I can be very light and very compassionate and so on, but I carry this core of hatred towards these people. You know, I have these whole groups, the fundamentalist Christians, the far-right Republicans, and they just identify themselves with that category without even knowing how they feel about gays and like that. Automatically, I just loathe them. And I tell myself, I feel I'm very justified. I can easily justify that feeling, but I'm tired of carrying this around with me. And I would really like to get to a point where I just don't hate as much as I hate right now.
Yeah. I hear you. I struggle with it as an activist. I mean, mm-hmm. And some of the guys in here that are, I've had a meditation group on Monday nights, and they've seen me sometimes come in like raging. So, yes.
For many years, as a teenager, I started early. I started having sex early, surreptitiously. Public restrooms with married men with older people, and I was well into my 20s when I began to connect sex and love.
Right.
And that was a very painful, lonely time that extended for a long time.
Oh yeah, I hear you.
Joe?
Yes?
I know for me, when I got into my first job out of college with a big oil company, it just didn't feel safe to be myself.
Right.
And it wasn't so much that there were these outward things, but it was also the way I'd been raised. And I think, and when I look back, it made me more, the way I've been raised and things I heard from outside made me more timid, made me question my opinions, made me hold back and, you know, being myself, and it's so easy to look back and say, well, you know, if only I would have been myself when I was at that company, maybe I could have been, you know, like helping to change things like Harvey Milk did. But that's a level of shame that comes in retrospect. speak. Oh, yeah. Like, why couldn't I have done? But and it's so easy to do that, to turn the lens on ourselves and question our motives back then, when really we were doing the very best we could with the inputs we had received. You know?
Yeah, and I think that's a really good point. And we also, it sounds like you're at least openly gay with your friends and family, right, at that time. And that's how we stand on the shoulders of previous generations, you know, because some men had sex with men, but they denied any sort of what that meant or anything or any sort of gay identity. So we always have to be very kind to ourselves. It was a very difficult time to be out. Yes, Jeff.
I really appreciate this talk. And I was particularly moved in your videos of Harvey's nephew. And what I got from that was, and this is something I struggle with myself, being in my mid-50s, finally understanding this in a new way, but that our authenticity is our gift to the world,
yeah,
including our gayness and, you know, with all of us.
Yeah.
It's not just that we owe it to ourselves. It's, you know, it's our gift to the world.
Yeah, that's for sure. Well said. Right. Did you have great. Any other comments on this before we...
I just wanted to mention that I think being authentic and growing is a fluid thing. And just remember, Harvey Milk did not come out of the womb as a liberation person. He was in New York. He was a stockbroker on Wall Street. He was a Republican. He supported Barry Goldwater in a rebellious sort of academic way. But, you know, he was closeted. So it's not like you're born that way. It's evolution. It's fluid. And we should never, or try not to beat ourselves up for our past struggles, because it is... something we went through, and hopefully when we come out of it, as we progress, we have more understanding and more wisdom, but that it's a fluid thing, and everybody, he was as mortal as all of us.
Yes.
You know, he was not a magician. I could tell you a lot of negative things, but I won't right now.
but later.
You know, that it's a process, and we go through that, we learn, and we fall back, and we move on, and we accept ourselves, and then we doubt ourselves. So it's just a part of the dance of life, you know.
Well said. I think, you know, the reason I'm showing I think I'm 17 in this photo, is like, yeah, I mean, to ask any more of ourselves than what we could do back then. I remember, you know, I was a junior in high school here in Vero Beach, Florida, and I saw what the rednecks did to anyone they perceived to be gay. And there was this guy who was a womanizer, but he was Cuban, and he had like a red sports car, and they decided he was a fag, their term, and they went after this guy. And it was very, very chilling. So, you know, I knew I couldn't be Harvey Milk in high school, you know. And I think it's a good point. All of us evolve, and society evolves. And even recently, there was going around the internet a series of clips, actually, of people talking about gay people in the 1980s on TV from the 1980s. And it's just amazing how we changed from the 1980s. But I want to... There's a couple more things I want to share with you about this. And this, I'm really picking up on this idea of doing the best we can. Maybe the best expression of Harvey's belief in our basic goodness was his strategy of encouraging gay people to come out to their families, friends, and employers, no matter how difficult this was to do. He felt it would help us overcome our shame as well as advance our movement, and it would humanize us. A bit of history. After the Stonewall riots of 1969, the gay rights movement started to bloom in the early 1970s, with thousands of activists challenging the pillars of institutionalized homophobia, government policies, the military, churches, business practices. But by the mid-70s, there was a conservative backlash with anti-gay conservatives like Anita Bryan out there trying to invalidate a number of LGBT anti-discrimination laws that had been passed in communities around the country. In California, State Senator John Briggs put Proposition 6 on the ballot, a draconian law that would have allowed public schools to fire gay teachers and anyone else that supported them. Imagine. That happened in California. It looked like it was going to pass, and they were down, you know, considerably in the polls. And Harvey and others realized that gay people needed to talk to their family and friends about this proposed law if we were going to defeat it. People knew who someone were gay. Of those people who knew that someone were gay, they were more than 2-to-1 more likely to vote against this proposition. Harvey believed that we had to show society that we weren't terrible monsters. Rather, we are society's children. And on the night of Proposition 6 being defeated, Harvey had these words about coming out.
Gay community all over this state, my message to you is, so far, a lot of people joined us and rejected Proposition 6, and now we owe them something. We owe them to continue the education campaign that took place. We must destroy the myths once and for all, shatter them. We must continue to speak out. And most importantly, every gay person must come out. As difficult as it is, you must tell your immediate family. You must tell your relatives. You must tell your friends, if indeed they are your friends. You must tell your neighbors. You must tell the people you work with. You must tell the people in the stores you shop in. And once they realize that we are indeed their children and we are indeed everywhere, every myth, every lie, every innuendo will be destroyed once and for all. And once you do, you will feel so much better.
Yeah, this belief in the basic goodness of ourselves by coming out has been the central political strategy of the gay rights movement. It has helped us defeat Proposition 6. It has been the foundation for passing so many anti-discrimination laws across the country, forcing government to respond to the AIDS crisis, repealing Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and of course, our movement for full marriage equality. By proclaiming our basic humanity and goodness with the people that we know best, we have gained so much. Another thing that Harvey taught us to do was to extend this belief in our basic goodness to other people, to non-gay people. He reached out and saw the humanity and suffering of others, including blue-collar workers, migrant workers, seniors, kids, Latinas, African Americans, and even conservative suburbanites like Dan White, who eventually killed him. He liked people, and many people liked him, despite his homosexuality. He formed an alliance with Teamsters who were boycotting Coors Beer over the use of non-union truck drivers, and they became some of Harvey's best friends and political allies. What I think was most impressive to me as I sort of dug into the subject was how he was fearless in debating our opponents on their home turf in places like Orange County, San Bernardino, and Walnut Creek. He actually realized in those closing months of the Briggs campaign that he had to actually go out and meet with these people and show them that he wasn't this horrible monster, that gay people were just as human as they were. And of course, he used his great humor, reason, and passion to really humanize our cause and to open the hearts and minds of Californians about this important issue. And I, one of the things, you know, and I really appreciate your point, because let's face it, Harvey Milk was had a lot of human failings. But at least in public, he didn't belittle or demonize our opponents. I think that's a really critical thing. He didn't make them the other. He went out there and talked to them. And he channeled at these times, he channeled his best self and thereby brought out the best in others. And there was this one great quote that I found of Harvey's. I couldn't find it on videos. Is, you don't change a person like Quentin Kopp overnight, who is, I guess, a conservative supervisor. A lot of people don't realize the importance of opening dialogues. It's the only way you change people's views. So really, you like working with people, working with ourselves, our own suffering and shame, and then working with people, extending that. He understood how fear works, and one of the things I found is one of his co-presenters who went out on this Prop 6 campaign and said they came across two sets of fears. They came across during this Prop 6 time, and this was 1978, the fear in the gay community was, we're going back in the closet and we're going to be shut back there. And given all the love and all the advances, we were going back. So our community was really frightened. But they had a sense of what the other side was feeling. The conservative Christians who were being asked to change their fundamental beliefs on something that had stood from the test of time. Of course you make fun of the gay people. Of course you oppress them. And this idea of protecting them and actually having them teach your kids, it was really radical. And it was really scary. And understanding people's fears, not just demonizing, but understanding them, made Harvey and his cohorts much more effective in advancing our cause. And I, as an LGBT activist, I'm always trying to separate my opponents' fears from their actions, not condemning them as people, but only their deeds and words. I want to hold out the possibility that they can be moved from love to fear. Like George Wallace and Republican strategist Lee Atwater did towards the end of their lives. And I think Harvey understood if we ask others to see our humanity beyond the stereotypes, we need to do the same with straight people. We must talk with them, engage with them, share ourselves, and look for common ground. And he had another quote, let's make no mistake about this. The American dream starts with the neighborhoods. To sit on the front steps, whether it's in a small town or a concrete stoop in a big city, and to talk to our neighbors is infinitely more important than to huddle around a living room lounger and watch the make-believe world on TV. In summary, Harvey's been a really powerful icon in my life. He was flawed, messy, vain, loud, and erratic, sure. But in the end, he had the courage to be authentic, to talk about the suffering of our community and those who oppressed us, waking us up to our situation and dialoguing with others with skill and compassion. He was no saint, but he evolved into a leader of a movement that stands for equality, love, and self-acceptance. For me, we must always start here, sitting with ourselves and realizing our own basic goodness and then seeing it in other human beings. Speaking to this point with a great double entendre, Harvey said, we can change Phoenix, but we have to start with our own block, the Castro Street. Harvey was optimistic, believing in this basic goodness of man, in the interconnectedness of all people. And I want to end this talk with his famous words, about hope.
To let gay people, so that that young child and the thousands upon thousands like that child know that there's hope for a better world. There's hope for a better tomorrow. Without hope, not only gays, but those blacks, and the Asians, and the disabled, and the seniors, the S's, without hope, the S's give up. I know that you cannot live on hope alone, but without it, life is not worth living. And you, you've got to give them hope. Thank you very much.
Next week, our speaker will be Tom Moon. Tom is a practitioner of Vipassana meditation for over 15 years, and he's a psychologist here in San Francisco. He has a column in the local paper. He's been with us several times before, so he'll be our speaker next week. GBF has regular expenses of about $300 or more per week, so to help us defray our costs and do our newsletter, rent this space, everything that we do, we ask for a donation around $10 if you can manage that. Anything you can contribute is welcome. Do we have announcements?
Well, it's not quite an announcement. I just want to make one comment on your speech. Thank you so much for a really well presentation. Amazing. But I want to mention that what was so important also was Sangha.
Yeah.
Actually, in those days. And Harvey was in his 40s, and most of the guys in the cast that moved in were in our 20s.
Yeah.
So it was really a Sangha that made the whole movement go. He was the leader and the spokesman. And even with those, a statement of the hope speech, that was written by a man named Frank Robinson,
wow,
who just passed away 2 weeks ago. He was 87, and he wrote a lot of the words. So it was really a Sangha,
wow,
of people that made the movement. And we always have to remember that, not just wait to depend on one person, but it's all of us working,
yeah,
together.
That's a great story and perspective, too. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Philip, are you the host?
I am the host, and you know the drill. Wash your cups after tea. Sign up sheet for the Igloos Fellowship porn site. It's fabulous. You can use it to go out for lunch, and I'll be coming around with the Don Bull, and I want all your money. I only bought one breast. I still have to buy the other one.
I have an announcement. Jerry Martin, many of you may know, and also Tatwan, they both moved up to
Santa Rosa.
A place called Fountain Grove, I believe it is. And anyway, Saturday, October 3rd, they're inviting all of us up there for an afternoon of enjoyment and seeing the grounds. They're going to host us with lunch and drinks. There will be a tour where you can go see the place if you want. I don't think it's too much of a sales pitch, but
you get a toaster at the end.
Yeah, free toaster. But there will be vegan options, and then after that, people can hang out by the pool, explore the countryside. The vineyards should be turning color right around then, so it could turn out to be a really nice outing. And details will be forthcoming, but that's the first Saturday in October, the 3rd. And so we'll maybe manage carpools or something like that as we approach.
That's one of my personal friend, and I visited him up there a couple of times, and it really is a beautiful place. I'm not in a position right now to move into a retirement home, but if I wanted to do that, I could see the attraction of it. So I just recommend this much to myself.
Yeah, and we don't see them as often because they're all to Santa Rosa, so I think it would really be a nice way for us to gather in a different setting than we normally do here. So keep that in mind. We get letters quite frequently from prisoners who are seeking pen pals, and I got this one this week, all hand-drawn. I mean, it's a beautiful sentiment in here. I won't read it to you, but if anyone has been considering taking on a pen pal, we've got stacks of them, but it's a really good example of how heartfelt people are, and they're really just looking for community and friendship and spiritual friendship, not anything else. So we've got a really well-structured pen pal program that protects your anonymity and makes it very easy to correspond. You know, once or twice a month is all you need. So.
Well, who's the contact person for that if you want to follow through on that?
That would be me.
Okay.
So, any other announcements? Great. Well, let's gather in a circle for our dedication there.
By the power and truth of this practice, may all beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all be free from sorrow and the causes of sorrow. May all never be separated from the sacred happiness which is without sorrow. And may all live in equanimity without too much attachment or too much aversion, believing in the equality of all that lives.
Thank you, John.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Gay Buddhist Forum. If you would like to hear several new talks per month and be notified of upcoming speakers so you can participate live, please subscribe to this podcast, like us on Facebook, and join our mailing list by visiting gaybuddhist.org.